But the women running, running, running was a good success. The other thing that I used to attend was the annual commanding officers meeting in Portsmouth. And although not a commanding officer, but seemed to ignore that aspect. And I was the only woman who attended that with 100 other commanding officers. And I felt always on these occasions I was given much more priority than what to do to my rank. I also went to sea in a submarine during this time. I'm not sure of my cap, but I think between the wars there was a submarine was lost and they had wives and friends on board. And the American Navy had what they call petticoat days on submarine. And I think the Royal Navy wanted to start this up again. And so they invited the two superintendents, who happened to be the only two red superintendents, but they happened to be in the Portsmouth Command, as guinea pigs. The director then didn't want us to go, but we thought we weren't going to go down after this, particularly as the other superintendent and I had both started with Antigua, which was in it. Port Submariner, she in Port Dolphin, and I in London at the same time. So we had a very interesting day on board, and they arrived and they were working up before they went to Malta and Port Dolphin. It was a conventional submarine, not nuclear, a possum. And the conditions and the need for self-control and not blowing your top was very obvious. I mean, there were eight lieutenants on board and they had a space which just took four bunks over and a table in the middle which I think was the same. And that was our sleeping, their mess, and their office for safety. And the captain had a minute separate bunk in space. And when you walked down the gangway, just look at the engines and talk to people, the bunks were let down, and some of them off duty were sleeping. And as you were walking up and down. And the poor cook had a very small space, and of course, if they had to turn the electricity off or anything, he had no means of cooking. So it would have been very, very interesting. And so far, when we had not gone to the federal service, in the submarine. I think they had one as a trial. One girl went, one officer went to the trial. But it does require a very special outlook. I think going overseas, men's going overseas, was to come to Blanchard's to be treated up. So we had, and with the new entry training, we had a large clothing store and staff. And so I spent 2 years at before I was promoted to commandant and went up to the airport to direct him in.
We'll have a break now, I think, don't you, before your promotion. That had been. This would have been the year.
It was in the summer of about May, June of 67. And I took over from Dame Margaret Drummond, who had been a very excellent and wise director. And she and I had actually joined up as Run Ratings together in London. And of course, I was on the staff of the Second Sea Lord as one of his heads of department. And again, here, as on other occasions as a staff officer, I found the other heads of departments very supportive. And when they had a lunch every 6 months, they always we went out to some restaurant or on board Discovery or something like that. And they always included me. This was people like ACR and the director of Manning and the chaplains and the doctor and those. The great change for anybody going to the Admiralty after living in a naval mess is that you have to find your own flat to start with, and you have no staff. Even that applies to the Second Sea Lord. You're probably more busy than you've ever been, but your uniform and all that, if you haven't got a wife to help, you have to do it for her. And I have to confess, I cheated. A wren from the skirt from the wren officer's quarters in Prince's Gate used to come one morning a week and look after my uniform and brush up the flat, because my elderly parents were still alive and I had to look after them most weekends. So that was quite a contrast. Eventually I found a flat in Rochester Row and I could walk to work, which was a great pleasure. And it was also very useful when you were having transport to go on any occasion or any journey. And the first thing, you have a very brief handover with your predecessor. And then you go and call on the commander-in-chief, who is the Queen Mother, and you go usually with your predecessor. She has 10 minutes, and then you go and you have 10 minutes. And then also we went to call, or I went to call, on Princess Molina, who was our chief commandant.
How were you received by the Queen Mother? What was that like?
First when you went in, you first were entertained by the lady in waiting, or the gentleman in waiting, while your predecessor was in. And that was always fun, it was always very easy to talk to. And then you sat down, and the Queen Mother, of course, is quite easy to talk to too. And she chats about what you're hoping to do in the service. Or when you leave, what you have done, etc. And then and you tell her anything you think she might be interested in. And then she picks up her handbag and you get up and curtsy and go on your way.
Was she well informed, did you find, about the games?
Yes, she was. And of course, the Queen was interested too. When I went to lunch at Buckingham Palace later on, I think it was in about 69, as I was going out, the Queen didn't actually ask me any questions at that occasion. The Duke, who I sat next to, did. But the lady in waiting came up after as I was going out and asked me what our policy was about bills and taking pills and abortions and what the policy was on that respect. And well, we didn't support abortions, and if they happened, we didn't know about it, but it would be in the medical side. But, and no pills were issued either, as far as.
That would have been the contraceptive pill,
yes,
would it?
That's what I meant to say then. And Princess Marina was very relaxed, and we went in just before for a pre-lunch drink, really, and she poured it out herself. And she was very well aware of, and offered you a cigarette from her beautiful case. But she was very well aware of what was going on in Rennes and took a great interest. And that was always great fun, too. She enjoyed it all very much indeed. I don't know whether, while we're onto that side of the royal, when Princess Marina died, I had been in office about halfway through. And I attended the memorial service at Westminster Abbey. And even before the memorial service, Sir Philip Hay, her secretary, had rung me up with two questions. One, what should he do with her uniforms? And so they went to the Museum at Greenwich, the Naval Museum. And then he said, and what do you want about a replacement to your chief commandant? And so I said, well, I thought it was a bit too soon to. Oh, no, he said, well, I'm being rung up by all the organisations. But I think I should tell you that Princess Alexandra, if you were thinking about, already has two service. She's commandant of two of the nursing services. And he said, I don't think that three out of six would be, the three directors and the three nursing. So he said, I thought I'd better warn you. Which was very kind and very helpful. They made it a bit difficult, because I think some people would automatically have wanted Princess Alexandra, but I put it to the Naval Board. They decided, with my concurrence, to ask for Princess Anne. But at that time, she was, I think, only 18 or not quite. They said we would have to wait. And so we did wait, and I didn't have another chief commandant in my time. But during my successor's time, Princess Anne was appointed, and of course has been a tremendous success, because she's very practical and very with it too, and takes a tremendous interest. And for instance, she nearly always comes to our Benevolent Trust meeting, and at the time of the Falklands, she took the Chief Wren's welfare aside, but they'd been giving a talk on their work with the relatives and the wounded coming back, and she wanted to know more, so she took me aside and had a quarter of an hour with them. So in the end, that was a great success. I'm sure Princess Alexandra would have been delightful too, like her mother, but it didn't work that way.
Yes, what was your work actually? What were you actually doing as director of Rennes? What were your duties?
Well, I've got visiting every establishment once at least during my time. And then I was responsible for the Rennes officer's training at Greenwich. There was a Rennes officer, the chief officer there, doing the actual running of the book. But I went down three times a term, once for to give a lecture, once to for the promotion board when we decided who was going to be, if they were going to be promoted, and then for the passing out parade. But one of my main concerns was to try and get more varied do it before the Wren officers and ratings, because with the inevitable closures after the war, Sea Eagle in Londonderry had gone, and HMS Harrier and several air stations. And it was beginning to look as if everything was concentrating on its own port. And of course, Chatham was going to close too. And with catastrophes like the radar plot and the range assessors, when they joined up, they were looking for excitement and a challenge, and they weren't going to sit around the home port. So one of my things was to try and get more overseas and different opportunities in the Navy. I mean, I think in that time we got air traffic control officers. We had some in the war, but I think some of them started up. And the primary officer in HMS Dryad was very helpful, and partly I think because he valued having the radar plot runs as part of his navigation team, and he was getting worried that we weren't getting the ones he wanted. So he got us, I think, two jobs in Canada, two jobs, and then we got two jobs in Holland, the Dutch Navy. And eventually, when there was a change of Commodore in Hong Kong, he said he would like to have runs. And we got some jobs for radar plot and other ratings in Hong Kong. And we had, when I joined, we had about six overseas establishments with Malta and Gibraltar, and NATO in Oslo. That was my first visit, and the CEO very kindly, the Admiral very kindly invited me, so that I had the weekend with them and watched the Holman Cone ski jumping, which is the big event in Oslo. So that was another of these lovely perks that you get.
Yes, what other perks did you have? You
well, I think that was a bluebay, which weren't then in fun. I bought one in Oslo. I told you about the other perks. I told you about the lady and the other perks. One was attending the ladies' day at Wimbledon. Princess Marina, I think, was president of the old Wimbledon tennis club. And so we had wonderful seats in the royal box and tea with her in the entertainment hall. And another privilege, I attended the Prince of Wales investiture, and the Second Sea Lord invited any of the heads of departments to fly up in the aircraft to Anglesey with Lady Twiss and himself. And we spent the night in a hotel near Carnarvon, and then attended the ceremony the next day. I must say it was rather wet, and not it was rather a cold day, but it was a very impressive occasion. And we sat on very clever seats, which were made of red wood and put over concrete slabs, so that they stayed in one place. And you could buy these afterwards, and they were shipped off to you in a box. So I have one of those. I think those are the main ones that I remember now, but there were all sorts of other invitations that one got. One special trip, the Dutch Mara, which was their winning service, had their 25th anniversary, and they invited the director from England because they had all trained over in here as soon as the war was over. And so I went over for 5 days and made good friends with the little Dutch director, and there was no big reception. And then another day, I flew with the Dutch Fleet Air Arm, helicoptered round Holland, and we had lunch with them in their mess. When they said grace, I thought, I was very impressed that the naval officers all said grace before they had their lunch. And then another day we went down to the naval barracks in Amsterdam, or up to the naval barracks in Amsterdam, and the captain and his wife took us in his barge around the canals, and he knew a lot about the history and told us all about that. And that also enabled us to get some men's to work in the Dutch Navy. And I think they were Met runs and radar plot, and that took place fairly soon. And then soon after, I exchanged the Dutchman officer in England, and we took her to Greenwich and to the theatre. And also, I took her down to Portsmouth, where we stayed with the commander in chief, and we went to Dryad. Which was a radar plot training post, and it was arranged that some Dutch men would come and work there because, of course, they're bilingual and they work in English. So that visit was a great success too. Mm-hmm.
Well, were you involved with any of the NATO exercises?
I wasn't myself. The Rens working in these places, we had some in Brussels, they would be involved with them. And later we had some in Italy and NATO, but I was not personally involved with that. And I went out to Hong Kong to agree what would happen when they had Rens about that. And then to Singapore, where we had a quite a well-established unit. Mm-hmm. And I also went to Mauritius, which was a lovely. That was a very popular draft. We had 40 communication runs living in the centre of the island. And there was quite a little naval establishment there. There were no families. The dental officer got very worried, he told me, because all the sugar cane on the island, they put extra sugar in the soft drinks, and all the children's teeth were suffering accordingly. But I had I had to stay a week because of the aircraft coming and going. The Wrens loved it, and they all became very keen on swimming sub-aqua. And nearly all of them could show you treasures from the deep with silver doubloons and things they had found, seashells. And they had to train properly and start off in swimming pools. And I was allowed to snorkel in the coral reef. That was a great perk for me. The Wrens, the director of Manning used to come to my office in despair from time to time, because although this is a long time ago, the Navy were having difficulty in meeting all their requirements, particularly in categories which required a more advanced education. And he'd come into my office and sink into a chair and say, "The Wrens will have to go to sea." So, Dame Catherine Furze, having said, "Well, as long as women have the strength, they should undertake whatever jobs the Navy needs." I said, "Well, I've never looked for this, and I'm not one that really has thought about it." But if it's necessary, I'm prepared for it to be investigated. So they did have two naval captains. They didn't never came and talked to me, but I presume they went to the ships and decided what women could do and couldn't do in the physical sense. And I understood the main thing was the damage control doors in an emergency were very heavy and much of water they might not be able to cope with. There was in fact very little, but the Sea Lords didn't think it was a good thing. And of course there were difficulties because we were still not under the Discipline Act. And Wrens could just go at any time. And our training was still in separate parts. We were still at Frauntless. We hadn't got a new, and of course they didn't have to do any sea training and they didn't handle arms from an official point of view. So that didn't come about. We looked at the ships that went out for the day from places like Portsmouth and Plymouth, but that was no good because the men on board were already, this was counted as sort of home leave, they were living in their homes. And the Navy really were having, I think, quite a difficult time, they still are, because if they are short, they send the men to sea, and that means their seashore ratio of time is very unbalanced. They're away from their families much more, and that, of course, means they don't sign on. And so I heard no more about that.
It's interesting it was mooted, though. This would have been in the late 60s, wouldn't it? Yes.
Most people, most of them were throwing up their hands in horror at the thought. And the naval ratings. And I'm quite sure in my own mind, and in fact, I was talking to a former First Sea Lord last week, and who was in the chair when the Wrens did go to sea. And he, and it's the first time I've had it actually admitted to me, that the reason the Wrens went to sea was because they couldn't get the men to man the ships. Everything is so complicated now with computers and that you've got to have a much higher education. That you don't have anybody like the Hero or the Human anymore, or the ERA who shoveled coal, or any of these people. And also, I know this same First Sea Lord, before he retired, gave warning that the officers and the ratings qualifications were getting nearer and nearer together. And of course, in these days of computers, young men can get very good jobs at home with more money, and they don't have to be ratings. And you no longer get people coming in from public schools and Oxford. So, I'm absolutely sure in my mind that if the men had been able to man the ships, the Wrens would never have gone to sea.
So it was a very practical reason, rather than in terms of sort of gender equality.
I think women's lib had nothing to do with it. I think the director of the time, and I think he ought to have some, but she may have supported it and been keen on the Wrens. But I don't think that was the real factor behind it. Mm. Because it was an expensive job of mending and adjusting the ships and everything like that. And of course it complicated other matters.
Yes, I was wondering, you know, how important it would be, the proximity, you know, on a ship of men and women, you know, how that came into it as a factor, the sort of complications, emotional, sexual,
well,
this
I
sort
think, I think it is a complication. I don't see really how it could be other. And one of the difficulties is I see it, of course, we hadn't got enough women senior ratings and officers